Okay. So this is one of those, I didn't get that up till now. Up till now, I thought you were talking about homebrew, because almost everything in QEX, the Amateurs Exchange of ARRL, are homebrew-like articles. So you're saying, this guy is saying, he wrote a check and the problem went away. That's a very different approach. Okay. Now, Glenn's got a third approach here. Hey, Glenn, let's see how you would solve this one. KCQQIQ. Mr. Power Supply, K2RIW.
Well, I'd just like to speak from a project that I did recently. I'm pretty sure Eric knows the project that I'm talking about, because I was talking about it one rainy night here in the middle of the winter while I was working on it. It's just basically a group of transistor modules that I placed together to form a kilowatt output. Basically, I was doing it for, you know, an AM transmitter on 7580 watts, but the transistors that you can buy today and, you know, basically make quad modules and, you know, push-pull modules at 48 volts. To build a 48-volt power supply, here again, now you can go into the switchers or you can buy them at 48 volts and build up a kilowatt really nice, and you're going to wind up with power factor correction and all kinds of great things that you can even probably operate this off of a 115-amp wall outlet. Not only that, one thing we don't discuss enough, I think, here on the TechNet is some transistor applications of high power and the use of combiners. I'm surprised more people don't ask about it. You know, combining different groups of transistors and how to and to divide the inputs so that you wind up with a nice 50-ohm match on the input side and a nice, beautiful 50-ohm match on the output side. And the voltages are much safer to work with. The insulation materials are easy to get a hold of. Power supplies are easier to design and put together and get different things, or stack 12-volt supplies to get 48 volts. And I think the there's just not enough, people doing it and talking about it here. You know, everybody seems to go to the tube, but you've got to deal with those lethal high voltages and all these issues associated with high voltage. I'm not sure how well that's going to be taken here on the net, but let me pass it back to you, Dick. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Dick, real quick.
Yeah, go ahead, Eric. And boy, if I got comments on what Glenn just said. You got it, Eric.
Yeah, just going with what Glenn says. Last year, I think it was in the summer, there's a construction article. Two transistors get you 1.2 kilowatts on HF. It's a really good construction article. It actually is the research results of the guys at Tokyo High Power Labs in Japan. But two transistors will get you that. You don't need the combiners. You don't need all the extra stuff. You just need good heat sinking and good layout. You follow their layout rules. It's not an incredibly hard problem. You don't need that much of a power supply. It runs on 50 volts. You know, it just doesn't have to be perfectly regulated and perfectly ripple-free, but, you know, the better it helps. But there are a number of articles out there. If you want to do four transistors, I can recommend four transistors at basically 350 watts apiece. You can put them together, etc. You don't have to go with the smaller modules and then do the combining and then run into all the problems that you have with that. The technology is there if you don't mind spending $200 for a transistor.
Now, that amplifier with two transistors that ran a kilowatt rating that he said was in QEX, and obviously you can tell that when I open up my issues of QEX, I don't dig into the HF articles because I'm more of a VHF, UHF man. So I didn't pay attention to this article. I have to go back and look at my back issues. Did that article at the kilowatt rating with two transistors run 80 through 10 meters, 80, 40, 20, 15, 17, and so on, 10 meters. Did it cover all seven of those bands, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW?
Yeah, it does, and it's also sold commercially. I forget the model number. It's, you open up any QAC, you'll see the Tokyo High Power Labs HF amplifier. It's actually, the article came out before the product was actually manufactured and released.
Okay, if I really wanted to go all the way of writing a check and make the problem go away, and if I bought this Tokyo High Power Amplifier, kilowatt solid-state power supply, kilowatt amplifier, 80 through 10 meters, with the appropriate power supply, that combination, could I buy that for $4,000? Over to you, Eric.
No, you'd buy it for, I think, like $1,600 or $1,700, something like that. I forget. Actually, if you give me a minute, I can look it up for you. Actually, what they did was that they expanded their line. They made a lower power version of it using just one transistor. And I think that one produces like 900 watts, something like that.
Okay, that is kind of attractive. You're telling me I can buy it ready to roll at close to the price it's going to take me to buy the parts and put old man hours in there to put it together and debug it and make it work right. That is tempting. That is very tempting. Kilowatt-type amplifiers that people have been buying in the past, just the amplifier without the power supply, they've paid for numbers like that, tube-type amplifiers. Looks like it's a fun project you've got there, Ian. As you can tell, in the process of you talking to your fellow amateurs, as you build this thing up, as you debug it and start using it, you're going to hear a lot of opinions as to the right power supply, the right technique for the power supply, the right amplifier, the right tubes. So you're going to have a lot of fun with this one, Eric. And please come back from time to time and tell us how the project goes. You've got a beauty here. WO2Z, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, as usual, Dick, always a lot of information, and it's definitely appreciated. Don't check it a lot, but I listen often. Just one final question, and disregarding the power supplies, I think I'll start with a capacitor input, which is the simplest of all the designs. Later on, I might, depending, go to a choke input. I don't think I'll ever, unfortunately, go to a switching power supply or some of the other variants with the transistors and so forth. But regarding the 8877, I've seen a couple of designs using a filament choke, and a couple of designs not using a filament choke. Just a quick question. Any advice?
Yeah, it sounds like you're building a grounded grid amplifier. You're going to be grounding. You're going to be driving the cathode. And I think the 8877, the cathode and filament are, you know, all together wiring wise. Therefore, you're driving that combination. My recommendation is to put in the choke, so that none of the RF drive power ends up on the filament transformer. That's my recommendation. Mel's been there. Let's see what he feels on that one. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yes, this is K2KEY. I agree with you 100%, Dick. I think that the standard design, which has been around quite a while, for 8877, using a very good input network and going right into the cathode, has been a proven system for especially the 8877. The transformer for an 8877 is a 5 volt AC transformer, and you're going to have to if you're going to go through any other method, you're most likely going to have some problem with possibly that transformer. So I say stay with the proven system of, first of all, you can design some very good input network. That's the point. It's very important to have a very good input network, the input networks that I've seen, all of them were designed around, work into the cathode of the tube, Dick, over.
As you can see, that RF choke that we're talking about, Ian, keeps the RF energy primarily out of that filament transformer, where it can give you some grief. And the RF choke we're talking about is really just a coil of wire, the right number of turns, the right diameter. It's not an expensive component. It's something you homebrew, so I would not leave that out. WO2Z, K2RIW.
Okay, I appreciate all the advice, Nick. And I'll let you know if we get it up and running there. Most of the articles talk about, I do have a power supply already that I'd like to use, but I was thinking of probably just building one for that particular project. I'll take all the advice I've gotten tonight and let you know probably hopefully in a few months how things turn out.
Very good, Eric, with that project. Good luck, and keep us informed. Sounds like a lot of fun. And that's one of the real ham radio projects, building your own amplifier and bragging about it on the air, as opposed to just going out and buying something and getting on and talking. The real hams build their stuff. Frank, N2VUU, K2RIW, you got it, Frank.
Okay, my question is simple. It pertains to antennae, and you're the expert in that. I've built enough of them, tested them over the years, so I have experience in it. Here's my problem. I live in a house that's 12 feet high, 65 foot long with a metal roof, 12 foot to the top of the roof. Above the roof, from the back to the front, there are two steel nests, if you will, with an 80 meter flat top long wire with a counterpoise over on a 45 degree angle with the bowling, with the coax, about 9 yards. Works okay. I'm able to tune up on my tuner fairly well, although the close proximity of the wire to the roof, which is about 10 feet, is probably detuning the antenna to some degree, but again, the tuner does fairly well. My question is this. I'm going to try to keep it simple. Am I getting a high takeoff angle? Because I do make some good contacts, but I got a funny feeling. I'm not doing as well as I could. Does it affect the takeoff angle? And if so, is it going straight up? And if so, if I raise the antenna front to back, that flat top long wire, say another 10 feet away from the metal roof, which is the same length as the 80 meter antenna, okay, keeping that in mind, will I get a better takeoff angle? Would I do better? Is it worth it?
There's a yes and a no to that one, Frank. There's no hard answer on this one. Almost any antenna that you raise up is going to give you a little bit more performance, particularly a horizontally polarized antenna. The takeoff angle you're talking about, believe it or not, is almost not being affected by that roof. The roof is giving you an impedance change to that antenna, without a doubt. But if your antenna tuner has got enough range to it, that's not a problem. So that dipole of yours is acting really like a dipole. And although there's a massive amount of metal in that roof, and your eye sees that metal and says, boy, that must be disturbing the living daylights out of that antenna's impedance, out of its efficiency, out of its effective capture area, and out of its takeoff angle. Good common sense. Your eye looks at all that metal that's under that roof, under that tar, and that's what you think you see. Now let's put on a set of RF eyes. And let's make believe that our eyes are worked at 80 meters, where the wavelength is 365 feet. To a wave 365 feet wide and high. Let's assume that wave is square. It's a square sheet of metal, 365 feet on the side. That's what the real wavelength almost looks like. That sheet metal of your roof is nowhere near wide enough. It's long enough, but it's nowhere near wide enough. When it comes to the takeoff angle you get out on that horizon, the majority of that RF energy that's reflecting off of something, giving you that takeoff angle, is the dirt out in front of your antenna that clears the roof. It's a real ground 50 feet, 150 feet, and 300 feet out in front of that antenna in the direction you want to talk to. That's what's really giving you the takeoff angle, that dirt way out there. That little bit of metal you've got nearby, by comparison to the wavelength of 80 meters, it's rather minor. It's changing the impedance, it's not changing the capture area, it's not changing the efficiency, it's not changing the takeoff angle, it's only changing the local impedance. It's a local capacitive object near your dipole. That's my opinion. So when you raise it above the roof a little bit higher, wavelength-wise, 10 feet on 80 meters is not a
repeater. Time out.
10 feet of extra diff altitude on 80 meters, wavelength-wise, is not very much of a change. It's not going to be night and day. Now, when it comes to how well you're getting out, how well you're getting answers, how much power you're transmitting, who you're trying to talk to, what pilots you're trying to break into, there's a lot of variables involved that'll tell you, gee, I wish my antenna worked a little better. I wish more people would hear me. I wish more people would say I'm 40 over 9 on their S meter. I understand that. And there's various kinds of antennas and arrays of antennas, multiple elements, if you've got enough real estate, you can put up. Wire two-element Yagi, for instance, would be a very interesting antenna, or two-element phased array. If you've got enough trees around, you could put another parallel wire out there, and then phase between the two. It wouldn't be very expensive. It's going to give you a lot more gain in the desired direction. So, from my point of view, that metal of your roof is nowhere near as bad as you think on 80 meters. Now, Mel is much more of an HF person than I am. Guarantee he's got some opinions on this. He may have the opposite opinion. Let's find out what the antenna people on Dover Street in Manhattan Beach have got to say about all this. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Like 80 meters, my experiment, I've had a dipole, I have a vertical, and I had the loop. The dipole was somewhere in between the loop and the vertical. So what happened with the dipole, I now turned that into the 160-meter dipole. The 80-meter dipole became the 160. There are times, and I found this over and over again, there are times that the vertical definitely outperforms the loop. There are times that the loop outperforms the vertical. I have found, however, again, let's say one more word. When I compared the loop antenna to the dipole, the loop antenna at a lower altitude than the dipole did outperform it. I thought at first maybe I was dealing with basic NVIS situation, but I tried it on a number of stations. I tried it to make sure that that dipole was emphasizing the size fire of where those stations were. In other words, I evaluated this over a period of time, and I finally settled down that my two antennas for 80 meters. Now, I do a lot of 80 meters CW, and I get on 80 meter phone, yes. But I like 80 meter CW particularly. And on 80 meter CW, the vertical always outperforms the loop for some reason, with especially DX stations. No two ways about it. So I would assume that this is the situation. A number of the experiments were made, there was some write-ups about this, that they found, like on 80 meters, that what's going on, 50 wavelengths ahead of the antenna contributes a lot to its performance, Dick. Over.
In other words, I think you're saying the conductivity of the ground, whether up the seawater, freshwater, sand, heavy loam, or whatever, 50 wavelengths in front of the antenna, the nature of the ground was making a difference. Is that what you were saying, Mel? Go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. So I can attribute that I work out quite well on 80 meters with the factor that I have, the ocean 350 feet to my south and the ocean, the other side, to my north, about, 900 feet. The situation is that, it's the old cliche that my antenna working here, how it works, maybe very good for me, but somebody else would say, phooey, That's why loop antennas especially have gotten somewhat of a bad rap. They said, they're basically NVIS type of antennas. However, I do work with quite a number of people, especially operating on the 75-meter phone portion of the band using loops. And the reason for that is because they get a better coverage of 360 degrees to begin with. And again, they also said, for some reason, it has been confirmed that the loop outperforms the dipole. The loop at a lower altitude always outperforms a dipole. Like the dipole I had up here was 65 feet up. The loop is only 45 feet. And yet, I can say this is the findings I have. I know I hate to give recommendations, but especially with antennas. But this is what I've run into. My experience, over.
Been there, done that, and that's your experience, and that's what you're telling us about. That's as truthful as you can get. So as you can see, Frank, I think the metal of your roof is a lot more minor than you think. I think the 10 feet of extra altitude will make a slight change. I don't think it's going to be night and day. And there's a lot of other antenna experiments you can do if you've got the right kind of property to make a sloper, a vertical, a wire two-element or a three-element beam in your favorite direction. If you've got enough real estate out there in Holbrook, you're going to have a lot of fun with this one. Not necessarily by adding extra altitude. If it doesn't take a whole lot of heroic effort, give it a try. It's going to make a difference in the impedance, but I don't think it's going to make a huge difference in the performance. That's my guess, Frank. N2VUU, KQRIW.
Okay, I thought I'd get an in-depth report, knowing you for quite a few years, and I probably built 60 antennas in my lifetime, as I was a kid all the way up to an amateur. Done a lot of experimentation. I couldn't tell you how many antennas I gave away, from loops to verticals to beams. Nothing too big. But I wanted an engineering standpoint, so I'm not going to waste my time. I've got a crushed vertebrae in my back and a herniated disc in my neck, but I still manage to sheer determination to do what I'm going to do no matter what it takes. I'm that type of person. I don't lay down for anything, because that'll put me into depression again, and I don't need that. So as you can see, I'm determined. But I'm not going to go up there, waste my time. As you said, 10 feet isn't going to make much of a difference. And from an engineering standpoint, from what you said, I comprehend it. I might not be able to tell someone that, but I can comprehend what you said. So I'm, by all means, doing pretty good on a lousy 100 watts, because I do make satisfactory contacts. I'm not looking to be a 1,500 watts big gun with beams and all. I don't have the real estate to support that. But I needed at least an engineering standpoint from you and from the other fellow out there as not to waste my time. So it took me 2.5 months, almost 3 months, to get this across to you because you have been pretty busy out there. One conversation, of course, always leads into another. So back over to you, Dick, from N2VUU.
Very fine, Frank. You've done something rather unusual. If I understand correctly from QRZ.com, that you had the call letters of November 2, Victor, Uniform, Uniform, and you've converted that over to Whiskey, November 2, Victor, Uniform, Uniform. In other words, you went from a 1x3 to a 2x3. If I'm reading QRZ correctly, that's an unusual change. Am I misreading it? And give us a couple words as to what you did there, Frank. N2VUU, or WN2VUU, KQRIW.
You're the 300th person that asked that. They always wonder, why did you do such a thing? Well, my answer to that is, I had a friend, W2WDW, very well known. He used to work at RCA, the old RCA. He was a transmitting technician, very well known on 2 meters. You might have heard of him. I think the whole world at one time heard of him, because that was Bill, W2WDW. When he passed away, a very good friend of mine, I just took the W, and out of respect, I put it in front of the N. That's all there was to it. It was kind of a personal thing, and I've got some of his old equipment, because he was kind of a very personal good friend, very close friend. We worked together on many, many projects. And that's the reason why I did it, not for vanity or for any other reason or to make the call sign sound impressive. It's just I stuck the W there. Now, at times I say N2VUU because I'm so used to that call sign, I forget to put the W in front of it. But as you can see on the website, I did a search and no one took N2VUU yet. So I occasionally dropped that in there out of having so many years been N2VUU. I think that might clear it up.
A little bit. Your preference, your desire, you enjoy it, go for it. Okay. Good luck with those projects. Do hope you get a chance to get your back healed well enough that you can do some further antenna experiments, because they're always fun. That's where amateurs shine. Not so often do we build a brand new 80 through 10 meter single sideband transceiver. you buy a thing like that nowadays, but we do build our antennas, particularly when it comes to numbers like 160 and 80 meters and 40 meters. We tend to really build them. I think we've gone down the list of everyone who signed in. And in case, I'm gonna give a standby in case there's anyone else that wants to join us with a question. If not, Mel's going to open up his mailbag and we'll find out what kind of antenna questions he's gotten questions on this week. K2KEY, to take it with a great big delay, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Mike Yankee, and my only question is, can anyone hear me? I've been playing with the radio all day.
Mr. Mike Yankee, we're hearing you very well. I didn't get your prefix, and I didn't get your name. And are you signing in by way of IRLP? Go ahead.
This is a mobile station, and it's Kilo Charlie 2, Mike Yankee. And I'm just sitting here in my car in Yonkers. I forgot what the acronym you just said stood for. I don't do this every day. Over.
Okay, this is the technical net that meets every Sunday night. A group of guys get together, a meeting of the clan, in which we discuss information back and forth. So, okay, you're coming in rather well from your mobile in Yonkers. Mel, looks like it's time to open up your mailbag. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Final word. Maybe one more advantage of that is that feeding it with that open wire feeders dropping down, you know, a good distance down from the antenna. That seems to be the rule of thumb with most of the people. I don't know. I've never gotten, you know, to the point where I can easily experiment with tilting a bearing the feed situation through the loop. But it seems to be that most everybody that runs the loop always says, oh, as long as you drop the 600 ohm feeders straight down at least 35 feet, it will perform excellent. They're trying to, of course, intimate that the loop in some respects going to act as a hop loaded vertical, maybe, Dick, but I haven't been able to, you know, really iron out that factor, over.
Yeah, because you have the ability to independently feed the left side and the right side of your open wire feeder, where you can adjust amplitude and phase, I have the impression you have the ability, by adjusting your controls on your antenna tuner network, you can slide from the thoroughly differential mode of feeding your loop antenna to the thoroughly common mode of feeding it. In one case, you're really feeding the loop with that open wire line, and whether or not the open wire line comes off straight down or out parallel doesn't matter. But when you're feeding it in the common mode, where you're putting the nearly exact same voltage and phase on the left side and right side of the open wire feeder, now you're feeding it as a kind of a capacitively loaded top hat, almost quarter wave vertical, but a vertical antenna. And that's a very different antenna. It'll have a different pattern, different signal strength for particular guys you're talking to, and a rather different load impedance also. An assumption that your antenna tuner matching network has enough range of its amplitude and phase of what you feed to the left side and the right side, I think you can keep it reasonably low in standing wave ratio while you do that slide function from differential mode to common mode. I wonder, Mel, do you find that the common mode tends to give you the strongest signal most of the time? Are there times when the differential mode gives you a stronger signal? And maybe I'm being a little bit too severe when I say the common mode and the differential mode, because you can slide continuously between the two. I guess you could make it 80% differential, 20% common mode, or 50-50, and so on. So maybe you keep track of it that way, by either percentages of the modes, or just writing down the control settings. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, Roger, this is K2KEY. And the funny part is, you know, there isn't any kind of set rule. I have done this experiment over and over again with my friends, and one night I watched the current meter in one wire. I emphasized that wire as getting its most current, and sometimes they'll tell me, oh, it's got a lot stronger. other nights I balance them, and they'll tell me that's an improvement. Other times I swing the other way. I guess maybe it's doing some kind of steering of the antenna system, because there have been experiments with the loops where they've actually been tilting the loops, actually causing, you know, in the shape of a diamond, big diamond loop, and being able to tilt, you know, tilt the whole thing, like, you know, by using winches. I mean, it's a little bit of a project, and maybe you're getting somewhat of the same effect when you, you know, actually, I guess they keep playing with the adjustment on the tuner and changing the loading characteristic. In other words, you always think that if the XWR was reading is the least, you should be doing the best, but not this case, it's over.
Yeah, when you go from the differential mode, I think primarily what you radiate is horizontally polarized. When you go over to the common mode, I think the majority of what you radiate is vertically polarized. So because of that antenna tuner matching network variable thing you got there, you can almost slide from horizontal to vertical polarization, and a few steps in between. So depending on the state of the ionosphere, the number of miles between the guy you're talking to and you, and the compass heading of that guy, there's going to be different settings that give you the best signal. One set of settings on reception, and another set of settings on transmission. Because the ionosphere has this Faraday rotation characteristic, most of the time it will not obey reciprocity. I'll bet you there's been multiple times, Mel, where you have seen one setting, one group of settings that give you the strongest S-meter deflection on reception, maybe an even slightly different set of settings that give you the best signal-to-noise ratio on reception. In other words, you may knock down the signal a little bit, but knock down the noise a little bit faster. And I guarantee there have been times when another set of settings gives you the best transmission, depending on what they tell you. You tell them, I'm changing the controls this way, and they say, yeah, that's getting better. And it would be real fun to have them feed it back to you on some other band or on the telephone, and you adjust the transmitting controls, and I guarantee the best setting for transmitting is sometimes quite different from the best settings for reception. Is there a partial confirmation of my speculations? K2KEY, K2RIW?
Yeah, most definitely. You can go crazy. You can come like a one-armed bandit. You're busy. Throughout the whole QSO, you're going to be busy swinging this way, turn it this way. How am I now? How back and forth? And you got to get, you know, a situation where the people are very, you know, they don't get antsy, as they say, because, you know, there's only a few on 75 I can really talk to get, make two tests with. A lot of them have no patience, really, and they leave it alone, it's okay, you know, and that kind of thing. But I'm trying to conduct an experiment here. That's what I tell them, but unfortunately, many times falls, as they say, on deaf ears. I can't pay attention to it. I don't know. The S-meter is bouncing all over the place. I can't tell what the heck is going on. You got QSD, you got QRN, you got this and that. So, you know, that's the situation. Usually what I'll do, for the most part, I just adjust it so best receiving signal, and I leave it at that, Dick. It simplifies things. Over.
Okay, so if I understand you correctly, you've seen evidence that a different setting will give you better transmission, but I think you're saying that from your point of view, the difference is not that dramatic. It doesn't make the QSO versus the non-QSO. So you settle for best reception and let the other guy suffer with whether or not that's the best transmission to him. Okay. What kind of mail have you got this week? And were the antenna questions? Over to you, Mel.
AL has dropped. Well, maybe somebody would want to join us. believe it or not, I lost all the email this week. Some kind of poop came in there. I opened it. I was looking down the line, and I tried to scroll, and all of a sudden I came up to delete all. I don't know where this came from. I asked my daughter and everything what's going on, but I have no idea. Very unusual occurrence, but who knows what was going on this week with all some of these people coming out of the woodwork, you know, messing up with the internet connections and all. I got a couple here that are left over that I remember from previous week. Lucky enough I have that, so I can take a couple of them over.
And to GOT, just checking in. Howard here, good evening. Over to you, Dick.
Hello, Howard. You do or don't have any questions?
Negative on the questions. Back over to you, Dick. I was going to add something else, but I guess we can add that later.
Sounds like you're mobile. Yeah, go ahead with your last week's questions, Mel. And I am curious as to that wipeout you had. Did that occur 4 days ago, 5 days ago, on April 1st? There were a lot of people worried that there was some kind of a crazy malware in a lot of people's computer, a worm that's in a lot of people's computer, and that it was going to give us some grief on April 1st, April Fool's Day. Over to you, Mel.
It wasn't Thursday. I think it was, Sunday. It was Friday I checked them, and I found the situation. Maybe it was a leftover, because I didn't get to use the computer since I think it was Tuesday. I've been busy with other things, just sort of skipped my mind. Let's see. Yeah, this question was here. Oh, don't ask. I mean, I got that somewhat of those questions left over with this vertical that we started to discuss. Verticals with elevated feeds. You know, will that be the same? In fact, here's a question. If I was using a horizontal dipole for 40 meters, 65 feet long, and the dipole was suspended between two structures, 65 feet tall, if one of the insulators let go, one of the supports let go, and during the QSO, the antenna went from a horizontal dipole to a vertical dipole, would the station hear any immediate change, Dick? Over.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt, he'd hear a change. Now the question is, would the signal he hear get louder or softer? Louder or smaller? Bigger or smaller? There's a lot of variables involved. First of all, when that insulator broke and the antenna swung down, most likely it would swing so that it's now parallel to the metal of the support if it's a tower. That's going to change the impedance of the antenna. But assume now that it was suspended from two 65-foot high trees and it swung down and laid against an insulated tree and the antenna was still being fed properly and properly impedance matched. It's a very similar question to what would happen if I had a horizontal dipole and a vertical dipole, and I flip between the two while I'm talking to the guy. Will he hear a difference? Answer is definitely yes. And there are some times when you go from horizontal to vertical, it's going to get stronger, and sometimes it's going to get weaker. Sometimes there'll be no change at all. Sometimes if you had the horizontal dipole and the vertical dipole, and you fed them simultaneously, half the power to each, what you would be electronically doing is generating a 45-degree slant polarization. A horizontal antenna and a vertical antenna fed in phase with equal power will give you a polarization that's midway between the two, slant 45. You could prove that with an oscilloscope, doing Lissajous patterns, if you know what I mean. If you've got separate horizontal input signal and vertical input signal to the deflection plates of your oscilloscope, and you could feed equal signal to both, and you'll make a 45-degree line across the screen. And in some days, that's going to be the best polarization if the guy wants to hear. Whether the guy you're talking to, horizontal or vertical, almost doesn't matter. If the signal is getting to him by way of the ionosphere, Faraday rotation is almost always there on HF frequencies. That signal goes through the ionosphere and gets twisted in polarization, some number of times. Some of the QSB fades that you hear are that twisting of the polarization, not necessarily the signal skipping over you or under you, so to speak. I'm amazed how little this is emphasized in any of the literature we read. Faraday rotation changes the function of 1 over frequency
repeater. Time out.
It changes as a function of 1 over frequency squared. By the time you get to 1296, the Faraday rotation almost doesn't exist. On 2 meters for the moonbound skies, there's a lot of it. There are times when they launch a horizontal signal, and it goes to the ionosphere and strikes the moon as a vertically polarized signal. The ionosphere on 2 meters will do that. By the time you get down to 80 meters, it's not just twisting at 45 degrees. I'll bet you it's twisting it 3 times in a row, if you know what I mean, 3 complete circles. And it's slowly changing the way it does the twisting. And as I said, all the literature we read tends not to emphasize this, almost doesn't even mention it. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, I'm going to give it a spin just in case somebody wants to come in via internet. I can see where you're coming from, Dick. Let's now get back to what we were talking about, vertical with elevated feed. Would you say then a vertical, an elevated feed vertical in some respects is a more or less now a vertical dipole kind of configuration, and that if you put up just a basic wire as a vertical dipole, that it would be most likely to perform the same thing as one of these verticals with elevated feed at the same altitude over?
That's a little bit strong. If I started off with a pure vertical ground plane with all the ground plane radials on the Earth, and I've got 4 radials out there, the minimum that the manufacturer might recommend, I'm going to get a certain amount of performance. I'm probably going to radiate 40% of my signal, and 60% of it's going to be coupled into the Earth and heating up the local soil. As I start putting more ground plane radials down, I go from 4 to 34. Now I'm making the backyard look not as much like dirt, but a lot more like a sheet of copper, as far as the radio signal is concerned. And now I'm going to get more like 80% efficiency and 20% heating of the soil beyond those ground plane radials. These are not the exact numbers. They're approximate numbers, my best guess. So I've now increased my radiation efficiency, but I've made very little change to the pattern, to the elevation lobes and whatever, when I just added more ground plane radials. The next step is I now build myself a elevated ground plane antenna. Because it has a phase center that's further above the Earth, because it is closer to electronically a half-wave antenna than a quarter-wave antenna, the ground plane radials are not as important. The phase center is higher. So for 2 reasons, I've improved in performance compared to the first step, the 4 radials. And I think it's a slight improvement over the 34 radials. So I've got a higher phase center, closer to a half wave instead of a quarter wave electronically. And even if the efficiency is almost the same as step 2 to step 3, because I've got a higher phase center, I've got a lower angle of radiation. Then the next step is a true half-wave antenna, purely vertical, where now the center of that is a quarter wave above ground or more. That's going to give me more performance yet. So I think it's a sliding performance from on the ground, few radials. On the ground, a lot of radials, that's better. Elevated feed point, that's better. Pure vertical dipole, best yet. And if you want to go...
Repeater, timeout.
And if you want to go beyond that in performance, now you take that pure vertical antenna and you start elevating it even further if you've got the resources to do it. So I think it's a sliding performance, lower angle of radiation, higher efficiency, a little bit more gain as you go through those steps, in my opinion, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Then you do believe that there is something to these antennas that they're marketing, these verticals, with the so-called elevated feed, that little or no radials on it,
that these antennas could be outperform a dipole, over.
Okay, now a pure horizontal dipole, if that was your comparison, that's a difficult comparison. So, when you say dipole, outperform a dipole, you didn't mean vertical dipole, did you, Mel? Go ahead.
Okay, let's do like I did for 30 meters. Remember, I did that experiment with the dipole being able to pull it up, raise it to the horizontal position, let it out with the weight, and see what happens if I go from horizontal down towards a sloper, down towards a vertical. In other words, will I outperform it by these methods? Or is elevated feed of some sort always going to outperform any kind of method that I come up with for a polarization of a dipole? In other words, is there any credulence to these safe statements that they're all putting out with these elevated feed verticals, which seem to have become a number of them on the market, with these claims, all band operation and, better than any dipole or whatever, or any other body's vertical, even with radials and whatnot. In other words, is there something that we're not taking into consideration about elevated feed that has some kind of superior performance over?
As you make an antenna go from quarter wave radiator to an electronically half wave radiator, when there is local stuff nearby, whether it be the fence or the guardrail of your balcony on your apartment, or whether it be the dirt in your backyard, as you slide from a quarter wave radiator to a half wave electronic radiator, I'm convinced you pick up an improvement. As you raise the phase center of the antenna above ground, as you're doing that elevated feed thing, instead of the feed point being right on the ground, which is the normal quarter wave ground plane radiator, that feed point is now some significant number of feet above the ground, that phase center point. That's an improvement. But will it outperform a pure vertical half-wave dipole? There I'm skeptical. I don't think it doesn't have more gain, it doesn't have more altitude, it doesn't have more efficiency. So it can't outperform a pure vertical half-wave dipole where the top of it is a half-wave above the ground. It can't outperform that in my mind. But it's a definite improvement, significant improvement over the ordinary quarter-wave ground plane, in my opinion. Now, in your case, you also were sloping where you've got this parabolic curve. That makes things a little bit more complicated because any comparison to horizontal and vertical polarization of an antenna, there are multiple things going on there. How many guys have you talked to? Where are they located? What was the Faraday rotation of the ionosphere doing that particular day? So polarization-wise, that's a factor. How far the phase center is above the ground, that's a factor. So a lot of things are changing simultaneously as you did that lanyard experiment of yours with the sloper-like parabolic curved, nearly vertical dipole that's connected to your evergreen tree in the backyard, in the front yard. A lot of things are happening there simultaneously. So this is what I think we would find if we did a scientific experiment comparing these antennas. You and I haven't done this yet, so there's a bit of speculation.
Repeater, time out.
We haven't done these experiments, so there's a bit of speculation involved here. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Golf Yankee November.
Mr. Golf Yankee November, give us the full call and your name, sir. And do you have a question or comment?
Full call is November 2, Golf Yankee November. And the name is John, and I'm here and located in Deer Park. And I have a question, if that's okay.
Sure do. You're allowed to have a question. I'm curious as to which one of the inputs to this repeater you're using, John. Go ahead.
I'm on the 375 machine, I believe.
Yep, I'm hearing you very nicely on the 375 input. I think you said you're in Deer Park. You're in my backyard, John. Go ahead with your question.
Yeah, okay, Vic. I've known of you and seen you many times at the Ham Fest and the various field day for the past 20 years. Probably don't recognize my call, but probably if you see me, you would know. My question is this. It has to do about a subject. I see a lot of dancing around on not talking about it. My question is on quad wire antennas, how they operate on bands of, let's say, 80 compared to 10 meters. Many years ago, it was one of my most favorite antennas was a 10-meter quad antenna, wire antenna. And what I liked about it is I can actually be in the middle of a QSO and sit there and switch back and forth and literally change as the polarization changes. Better horizontally and back and forth and literally sit there with my hand on the switch. Very interesting. I was wondering what your thoughts were, how that would work, and is it plausible for 80 meters?
You probably said, but I missed it, John. I'm looking at your picture with your hand held up to the camera, your thumb tucked in a little bit, wearing glasses and a beard. And I think I do recognize you, having met you a few times at various functions. The antenna you're describing that you're using now, if I understand correctly, you called it a quad antenna. Does that mean that it's a full wave, square loop, parallel to the ground? Or is it perpendicular to the ground? And you may have told me what band it's on, and I think I missed that one. And I think you've got various ways of feeding it. So run that by again as to what you've got right now, what band, how's it oriented, and how are you feeding it. Back to you, John.
Yeah, okay. Okay, Dick. K2I or WN2GYN. Yeah, I had taken years ago, I don't have it now, this was years ago, I had taken a 11-meter quad antenna, which you may be familiar with if you can bring your memory back that far. Avante made it, a PDL quad antenna. And I shortened each length of the extending elements to work on 10 meters. And that's what I'm referring to. If you're familiar with that antenna design.
Sorry to say, John, I'm not. So you're going to have to describe that to me. An 11-meter quad antenna. Was it a four-sided antenna where each side is a quarter wavelength long? Was the plane of the antenna parallel to the ground or perpendicular to the ground? You're going to have to give me... You're going to have to spell it out a little bit and draw me a mental picture of it first, John. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. It used two half waves, front and back, on a boom, which was fed by coax, and there was a hub involved. And although only one coax came down, you were able to use a switch box, and you would switch between vertical polarization and horizontal polarization. Maybe if there's someone even else on frequency, I can give you even more information about the particular antenna. It was like the small version of what they used to call a Moonraker antenna, which was used on 11 meters. But I had this PDL quad and had shortened the elements to make it resonant on 10, and worked very well. But not to focus on that antenna. Let's get off of just that particular antenna. Let's just say in general, what are your thoughts on running a quad wire antenna front to back on 80 meters or anything that's even commercially made
out there now. I don't even know if there's anything commercially made right now. N2G1.
Yeah, sorry to be so darn thick-headed on this one, John. I don't have a good mental picture of the antenna. Let me see if Mel is familiar with the antenna you're talking about. K2KUY, can you describe it to me, the antenna that John is discussing? You got it, Mel.
The KC2QIQ.
Okay. Mel first, and then briefly, and then pass it over to Glenn. Maybe each one of you guys have used one of these. You got it, Mel.
No, I have never had any experience, never operated 11 meters when it became a citizen fan. I only know of 11 meters when it was amateur radio. So that goes back quite a while ago, and that was my last real contact with 11 meters. Maybe Glenn has had more experience with 11 meters or antennas for 11 meters. KC2QIQ, this is K2KEY in the tech deck. Go ahead, Glenn.
Oh boy, I never thought my CB experience was going to come in handy, but here we go. What he's talking about, Dick, is a quad beam. Basically, some of the elements are actually wire wound quads mounted along a boom, and then I think in this particular application he's talking about two wire quad antennas with two feed points, one in the horizontal feed points of the diamond, one off the bottom feed on one of the on the other elements with a switch box. The Avanti Moonraker that he's talking about was basically two driven wire elements in the quad beam, and the rear reflector quad elements, and in the center there was actually like two like Yagi elements that that were basically the driven elements. Better picture, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
We're going in the direction of the picture, but I've still got a number of ambiguities. On 432 megacycles, a number of guys build cubical quad Yagi antennas, where each one of the elements, driven element, and each one of the parasitic elements of, let's say, a 10-element Yagi, every single element was not a flat-out piece of dipole, but a square loop of wire, one wavelength in diameter, approximately. And whether or not you suspended them in the diamond manner, where each one of these parasitic elements has a plane that's perpendicular to the ground, perpendicular to the boom, mounted on the boom in an insulated manner. And each one of them, you could either mount them so that they look like a diamond, or rotate the whole thing 45 degrees, and they look like squares. But each individual driven element, each individual parasitic element, is approximately a one wavelength cubical quad loop. Is that what you're describing, Glenn? Over to you, Glenn.
Yes, it is. And I believe that's the closer to the antenna that he was describing, is that it's basically a wire loop perpendicular to the ground along a boom, and then there's another, it's like a two-element beam. And his question that he's asking you is, what's the likelihood of increasing that for in geometry for 80 meters? Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
And one other question I've got for you, Glenn, and that is, when you've got a two-element version of this on 11 meters, which means it's going to be 8 feet on a side, roughly. So this thing is a 32-foot perimeter element, and there's two of them. And I have the impression he's got a switch where he can either feed the first one and the second one is fed later or parasitically. In other words, maybe there's a crisscross of feed line between the two, and you can either feed the first one or feed the second one, and therefore determine the direction of the main beam. I'm guessing that that's what it had, what its switching was doing. Or was the switching it between horizontal and vertical polarization? Over to you, Glenn.
Okay, and these type of beams for CB, what they would do is they would basically just switch them between horizontal and vertical polarization on one driven element, and the other element was the reflecting driven element.
You said reflecting driven element. Was the other element parasitic, or was it driven? And when you flip from horizontal to vertical polarization, if, for instance, it was a diamond arrangement, you're either feeding the diamond at the bottom or you're feeding the diamond at either the 3 o'clock or the 9 o'clock position. When you do that, I presume the relay that does the switching is right there at the driven element. Otherwise, the remaining feed line is